Welcome to the Classical Happy Hour. I'm your host, Martin Davids. This is the show where my guests and I talk about music while enjoying a tasty beverage, and we try to play some music together. Today's guest is Doyle Armbrust. So, great to see you, Doyle.
Good to see you too, Marty. It's been a little while.
It has, yeah. It's good that we finally got our dates to match up. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing for work these days.
Like, am I panhandling at the moment? No. I'm actually in the process of setting up a business. So I've got my LLC and actually just did some new headshots today. But I'm basically porting everything that I did administratively for Spectral Quartet over into a standalone business. So things like publicity, writing, branding, and then some sort of strategic things as well, you know, helping people figure out next steps for their career. And the long game is actually to have it move outside of the arts. It's going to start there, but that eventually it'll sort of encapsulate other vocations as well, because to me, everything about promoting the thing that you're making is about storytelling. And so that really is applicable to just about any industry.
So kind of like artist coach?
Yeah, there'll be a little bit of that. So interestingly enough, I was supposed to take the fall to just set up the business, say no to all work. I had kind of planned for it that way. And then, you know, sure enough, Spectral plays their last show, and, you know, people started calling and asking for help. So I've got a full-blown PR campaign going right now. I've got somebody that's looking for help assembling a board. I've got people that are looking for rewrites of their bio and all their website copy, or please take over my email list, that sort of thing. So it's gotten kind of frantic and crazy very quickly, which is a nice problem to have. But at the same time, I'm like, I'd like to finish my business plan first. So it's a little cart ahead of the horse, but so far so good.
Yeah. So for any of my listeners that don't know, you were the violist with the Spectral Quartet. From when did that form?
Yeah, our first bona fide concert was at the, let's see, Chicago the Cultural Center in 2010. And we just played our last Chicago show in June. But, you know, it's funny. I think sometimes people forget that when you make an album, it's a really long process. And so we let everybody know that we were going to be done, you know, this past season, but that we still had these other three projects. And even though I've got it like in every message that goes out, it's on our website, the first thing you see, people are still like, I don't get it. I thought you guys broke up.
Still making albums.
We're still making records. So actually tomorrow, well, I'm not sure when this will air, but we'll say in January, we will have released our first single for our album Behind the Wallpaper, which is kind of the first of these three big projects to come out, and that'll be released in March.
So are they all albums?
Sort of. Two of them, well, one of them's a studio recording, which is this Behind the Wallpaper. Composer's Alex Temple, and we've got Julia Holter singing on it. We have one called Plain Air, which is a project that we did that I think a lot of people in Chicago probably know about. We did it up at the Lakeshore Preserve, kind of right next to, what is that called? The big fort up there, Fort Sheridan. Mm-hmm. And that is, we're kind of thinking about something non-standard in terms of releasing that, like maybe something written, for instance, with, you know, accompanied by a download or something like that.
Vinyl.
I mean, if I have anything to say about it, it'll be vinyl. But Robin Wall Kimmerer, the really well-known ecologist, actually wrote some original, it's kind of prose poetry in a way for that. And so we're thinking about maybe releasing it more in the kind of literary genre rather than, you know, as a CD or something like that. And then the last one is this art film, is the best way I can think to put it. So Henri Dutilleux wrote this incredible string quartet, and I hate that I'm going to try to say the name of it now because my French absolutely sucks, but Ainsi la nuit, Thus the Night. And it was actually off my radar until Clara was like, we have to play this piece. I was like, all right, let's check it out. And I mean, I'll be damned. It's the most incredible string quartet. It's like, it's rocketed into my top 10 favorite pieces that we've ever played. And so 410 Media, this wonderful group out of New York, put together this film, basically. They shot it, and the artist Antonia Contro lent a bunch of her artwork and sort of made things too for this project. And so it's this somewhat surrealist video that you'll see us kind of bouncing around between like a skyscraper in downtown Chicago and then out on the lakeshore on Lake Michigan, you know, at a private home. But it's kind of intentionally. Yeah, so that one's in the bag, and now it's just a matter of we're still in the editing process on that, and films take a long time. But it's basically like, it's like MTV for a string quartet.
So it's a different image every 2 seconds?
I mean, it actually is a pretty kinetic film, and the thing that we're stoked about with it is that it's, I haven't seen anything like it in the classical realm, at least in the traditional classical realm, so I think it is... It's got some possibility to maybe make some waves, but we're going to take it. I think the idea is that we're going to take it around the kind of the film festival circuit.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, music videos for classical music, it's either you're on some label or you're on YouTube.
Right. But yeah. Where it sort of withers and, you know, maybe some high schooler looks at it every so often. But yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, concert footage can be great, but I don't know. You know, watching people play can be interesting, but I mean, I think having visuals that sort of like enhance and magnify what's happening musically, especially for a piece that's that specifically about darkness, about nighttime, about kind of the liminal space between, you know, being able to see and not, I think is really cool.
Yeah, the power of music isn't always aided by just watching a video of people playing it, you know? Whereas, you know, a story or dialogue is often hugely aided by music in its terms of emotional impact.
Yeah.
So why shouldn't the reverse be true? We can use it, visual things, to make the music come out more.
I think as long as it's thoughtful and, you know, I think as long as there's a reason behind it, it's, you know, bringing those things together, I think, just opens up a realm of possibility that you can't get from just playing something on stage. I think it's when, you know, we've all seen the video or the concert where somebody throws some video art behind them and you're just like, why is this happening? It's actually, it can be the opposite, right? It can actually detract from the music if it's not thoughtful, but if it's really kind of like seamlessly a piece of the aesthetic, I think it can just do things that the music on its own maybe, you know, can't.
Cool. Well, looking forward to seeing those. And yeah, I think people don't generally know how long it takes to edit like a CD, right?
Yeah.
If you think of how many tracks are on there and how excruciating it is to do even one of those, and if, you know, let's say you do one a day, it's a lot of days in a row that you'd have to hate yourself.
Yeah. We're masters at that at this point. I mean, these were all like mixed and mastered for the most part during the pandemic. And so if you add that layer of, so you have the layers of hating yourself and every sound that comes out of your instrument, the difficulty and length of time it takes to edit and mix, but then you're going to do that virtually. Like, it's just, it was really something.
Yeah. At least when you recorded it, you were all in the same room, right?
Yeah.
I mean, those days are gone. Thank God.
Indeed. Actually, the plain air record that I mentioned, I probably shouldn't be saying this because people are going to hear it, and I think it's like the best kept secret in Chicago. But speaking of Fort Sheridan, I got in touch with my old youth orchestra conductor, Alan Dennis from Midwest Young Artists, and we had basically a venue fall through, and then it was, you know, we were just having difficulty because a lot of these spaces were, you know, had really specific rules about who could be there, who couldn't. This is all, you know, still kind of during lockdown and masks and everything else. And so I got in touch with him and just said, you know, can I come check out the orchestra space, just kind of on a lark? And we got in there, and it was unbelievable how good the acoustic is just in the rehearsal room. And we got in there and I thought, well, maybe this is just me, or maybe I'm just happy to be doing something, you know, during lockdown. But, you know, the engineer, Bill Malone, who's from, you know, SAD and like a huge career, like he's the real deal. He came in there and he was just like, oh my God, this space sounds incredible. Now you have some things to deal with, like some, you know, fluorescent lights and stuff, but if you can work out some of the extraneous noise, I think it's actually one of the best live recording spaces in the city.
Wow. And is there a lot of traffic there?
Generally, I mean, there's the occasional train, but they're not so frequent. But they were actually taking down the tent that the orchestra has been using.
I know my kids played in the orchestra, so we
neglected to either be told or realize that that was going to be happening on one of our days of recording. And so, you know, everybody's got stories like this, but it was a negotiation with a bunch of, you know, Teamsters basically begging them for, you know, pockets of time that they wouldn't have, you know, a backhoe and forklift running. So,
right. Take a long lunch, guys. Cool. Yeah. So I didn't know that was available as a recording venue.
Hey, it's the spot. And if you're an alumni, you get it at a price.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't grow up here, so. All right. So how did you end up playing the viola?
Kind of like Spectral, I should have a better origin story, you know, inviting a radioactive spider or something. But no, the simple answer is that my mom read the Shinichi Suzuki book that, you know, I think everybody in the, you know, 1980s did, and was already a classical music fan, and she wanted to start my brother on something, and so she sort of schlepped us over to Wheaton College to the Suzuki program there and said, we'd like, you know, to have the boys play violin. And they said, violin studios are full, go play viola. And it was really as simple as that. And then my sister Rose came along, and we were already spending basically all of our weekends and, you know, most of our lives doing viola stuff. And so she just kind of rolled right into that mix.
You know, thank God.
I'm very grateful for it. I think I'd like myself less as a violinist. So,
yeah.
To say nothing about the instrument, I just mean me playing violin.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I mean, it's like all the bass players I talk to, none of them like intended to play the bass,
right? Yeah, no, it's, I mean, you have to put up with the requisite, whatever, people giving you a hard time about it, but like at a certain point too, being proficient at something that not a lot of people are good at, there's something to that. You know, there's a lot of space out there for people to make their mark.
Definitely, yeah. So did you know you were going to be a musician when you grew up, or did you want to be something else?
That's a good question. I think the inflection point for me was high school. So I was a real academic kid, and I remember going in to talk to it was a headmaster at the school, 30 people in my graduating class. Yeah, it was a really snooty college prep school, and I remember the headmaster basically trying to talk me out of going to music, just being like, why would you waste, you know, your abilities on something like music. It was maybe not quite that course, but, you know, it was something along the lines of, like, you can go to whatever college you want to. Like, why would you be looking into music? And then I remember certain family friends kind of having a similar reaction. And I guess what they didn't realize at that point was that telling me that I shouldn't do something was a great way to get me to do it. And so there was actually a little bit of, like, I'll show them to it. I think that was the point where I made the decision. It was that, or I was really interested in political science at the time. And so I remember I got like a presidential scholarship to the American University in DC, which would have been amazing on one level. And then got into Northwestern, and they were like, we'll give you our one you know, merit-based scholarship, and it was like $2,000 a year. So my parents, God bless them, said yes, and went from there. But
so, do you feel like it was the right decision?
I mean, have you checked our politics recently? I think I dodged a bullet on that one.
I don't know. You could have been the one to yeah, right. save us.
Yeah. Oh man, no, I'm grateful for it. I mean, it's, you know, anybody that plays an instrument professionally knows it's a, you know, it can be a struggle. It can be a tough life. I mean, even, well, to use my own example, like with Spectral, like we were doing really, really well, extremely well, but that doesn't always translate into making a super comfortable living financially. And so there are limits, you know, in terms of sort of like everyday life and the fulfillment you get from, you know, having one of those flow state experiences on stage.
True. A lot of the string players I've had on the show have sort of unconventional careers, and you're one of the more conventional guys because you were in a string quartet.
Right.
So did you always want to be in a quartet? Like, was that your idea, or did you want to be in an orchestra, or did you just not know?
Definitely wasn't planning on string quartet. My life was generally pointed towards orchestra. I went at it pretty hard in college, and then straight out of school, out of grad school, went to New World Symphony. And New World was really kind of the turning point for me, where I realized that I needed a little bit more agency than being a player in a section. And so I don't know. I moved back to Chicago, and I was working office managing for my dad's construction business and freelancing a lot, which is where you and I started hanging out the most. Mm-hmm. The quartet was really kind of like a... So if the fun part of freelancing for me was the variety of it, and like, you know, I love all the freelancers around Chicago. It's just a fun group to be around. Like, the never spending too long with any one piece of music, I think, is something that I was missing. And it turns out, you know, these other three guys in Chicago were having a similar vibe. And so we just like decided to start a hang. And so it was like the craft beer and string quartet hang. So we'd, you know, decide on a night, bring some beer, drink some beer, play some string quartets, and just really enjoyed it. You know, there was no goal necessarily to begin with. And yeah, it just started kind of spinning forward from there. So I kind of feel like I fell into string quartet a little bit, but definitely found my place there.
It seems so common. Like, a lot of people I talk to, where they ended up, they just had like a great experience, and they were like, oh, I found something I want to do more of, and they just kept doing it, and there they were.
Yeah. No, it is. It's interesting, like the opportunities that present themselves, like you never know when something's really going to grab your interest. And in this case, it's not like I was looking for a career change. It was more just like, God, I really like this. And I like that I'm the only person responsible for my part, you know, or thinking about, you know, we were super interested in contemporary music and not having to like make a case for that or convince some, you know, music director that they should be playing something, you know, after, I don't know, Bartok. That like being in total control thing was definitely, I didn't realize I was looking for that, but that's in fact what I was seeking out.
I mean, it's tough to always just play whatever people hire you to play, right? Even if it's great, you feel like a servant in a way.
Yeah, I don't know like how much of it is that like the sort of like power dynamic of it is just like, there is something about like, you know, I don't know, I've heard this phrase before of like, your programming is your mission statement. And there's something to that. Well, actually there's a lot to that, but, you know, being able to say like, this is what I'm about, you know, and not being worried about whether or not something is commercially viable or whether or not like the traditional audience will be into it or whatever, like, yeah, there's something, there's a little bit maybe there's still some of that same chip on the shoulder of like me deciding to go into music with that too, you know, just being like, well, why can't we do it this way? Or why not, you know? So that was actually a real driving kind of theme, I think, of Spectral all the way through, really, was like, well, it's kind of always been this one way. What if we did something different, you know? Chase down some crazy idea or, you know, had the music take place in some way that was completely unexpected.
So, I mean, the string quartet is this super traditional, like, mm-hmm. chamber music format. And I think a lot of people don't even realize how there are these, like, quartet societies and, like, all these places where you can do
friends of concert. Chamber music.
Yeah, I mean, yep. It's just set up for a lot of action. And it's also pretty well represented in terms of modern composition, right?
I mean, yeah, more so these days. I think my sense of it anyway, and I'd say that I've got a decent sense just in like the fact that I've done so much writing about music, so I stay aware of kind of who's out there and what they're playing. It does still kind of tend to fall down, you know, either on the traditional side or on the, you know, contemporary side. Now, that said, a lot of the more traditional groups are playing the odd piece by, you know, some Pulitzer Prize winner or whatever that kind of tucks, you know, to effective and less effective extents within the regular programming. I'm less familiar with groups doing it like we did, where it was really a 50-50, you know. And for us, it was really like, how amazing can Haydn, like, you know, the grandpappy of the string quartet, like, how fresh does that sound when you throw it up against something that was written last year? You know, no, that's not the end of the story. That piece actually has to have something about it that has something to say to Haydn for those things to work together. But for us, that always just made for more interesting programming.
So, like, what... Once you had the quartet and started working together, was it what you expected, or was there anything surprising about it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot that was surprising about it. I was surprised, and actually I've seen the other side of this now too, coming back to, like, I'm not necessarily coming back to freelancing, but I am doing the occasional sort of like gig with somebody else now that the quartet's finished. But what I remember from my time freelancing is that there's sort of a level of privacy or propriety when it comes to like how you will offer criticism to somebody else that you're playing with. So like what I remember, and maybe this has all changed, I don't think so, but that there's more caution or more sort of like talking around an issue. And once you're spending literally every day of the week rehearsing with the same four people, like you just lose that. You lose that veneer, right? And it's not that it gets mean. It's just that it gets really direct because there's an efficiency to that, right? And so I think that was surprising to me. The fact that I spent at least as much, if not more time with those three people as I did with my own family meant that a lot of personal stuff like didn't stay personal, like, because it couldn't, like, there's no way to hide, you know, when something tragic is going on in your life or something really amazing is happening in your life, like, there's no keeping that to yourself really, because these people end up knowing you as well as your spouse does. Those two things were really surprising. When I said the other end of the way that we talk to each other in the freelance world is like, you know, my first like bona fide freelance gig coming out was like a super, super fun, like microtonal, crazy bananas piece. And I was asked to, you know, kind of help with that because I do a lot of that playing, or had been doing a lot of that playing with the quartet. And we don't come across a lot of microtonal music in the freelance world. And as I was trying to, you know, be helpful in that rehearsal, I realized I was totally being that guy. Like that guy that like gets talked to after the gig. Like, dude, you need to rein it in. And I caught myself, I will give myself credit for like catching myself and going up afterwards and being like, hey, I just realized that like I was doing that thing that I'm not supposed to do. And I just want you to know it comes from a good place. I'm aware of it now. I'll take care of it. But like, you know, it's just, it's funny. Like, it really is such a different dynamic. Like, it really is a four-way marriage. And there's no, yeah, there's just, there, you lose all sense of, like, pretense.
Well, I think when you're a quartet or any ensemble of very few people, I mean, you're hearing everything that's going on. And if you're making a record or something, why wouldn't you just say, you know, you're, it's a little rushed in measure 55 or something, or I can't, it's not that clear what you're playing in this bar, or
yeah.
I mean, it's not like a, an attack on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
If you were just practicing by yourself and you heard that, you wouldn't be like, oh my God, how could you say that to yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it's, and it, there is still nuance to it, right? So, like, we even came up with some protocols around, like, what kind of comments we'd avoid at a dress rehearsal. Because, you know, at a certain point, like, that's just going to get inside your head for the concert and it's not productive. Or, like, you bring up recording, making comments in the, like, when you're editing is a whole different ballgame than making a comment in the moment. Because, like, when you've got mics in front of you and somebody says the wrong thing or it hits you the wrong way or whatever it is, it's already such a, like, nervy environment that, like, you really do have to be careful about how you deliver stuff like that.
I guess, yeah. I mean, you've got to read the room.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. When you do a ton of these things, and I think for a lot of us, the pandemic sort of made us record more than we mm-hmm. would have otherwise. So you're just used to it.
Yeah.
And you just don't want it to be bad, you know? So you're like,
yeah,
you know, it sounds bad in that bar. Let's just fix that now. I don't want to be listening to this later, because you can't go back later and fix it.
Right.
So, and recording, you've got this limited window
mm-hmm.
where you've just got to get it right.
Yeah. And
if you don't say anything... But I totally agree, yeah. The way you say it makes a big difference.
I mean, it sounds really obvious, but it's funny in the moment. Like, you're right about reading the room. Like, you might say something that's you mean completely in an innocuous or non-threatening way. But, like, if it comes at the wrong moment or somebody's just not in the right headspace or they're already a little self-conscious, like, yeah, it's something you have to be careful of. I mean, the thing is, I think I can say for all of us that we all came to really love recording. You know, so it's not always a tense situation, and you do sort of, like, you know, learn your own language or code around, like, how to do it. But I think a turning point for us was realizing that, like, recording just is a completely different medium. Like, it is not trying to capture a performance. It's just not the same. And it informed a lot of the ways that we even sort of mechanically went about recording.
It's hard to figure out, you know, if you should try to be super interesting or super accurate or...
Well, we had a really eye-opening moment with the, like, this art film that I'm talking about with this Do To You piece. You know, we agreed to do it very much at the end of our run on the promise that when we recorded it, it would not be a full-blown recording session. It's like, we're going to do 3 takes of each, you know, we had kind of sections laid out. We'll do 3 takes of, you know, I don't remember how many it was, like maybe 10 sections or something like that. And that's it. Like, if there's anything that's just like, oh my God, embarrassing, we'll go back and grab it if we need to. But other than that, like, this is not going to be, you know, us micromanaging every aspect of everything. And it was really pretty surprising to get to the end of that. And, like, I'm as proud of that recording as I am of anything that we did micromanage. Like, as it turns out, like, giving ourselves that limitation brought a different level of playing and also, like, kind of reordered some priorities, I think, in a way that, like, that recording is not sort of quote-unquote perfect. I mean, all the notes are there. Everything is there. There's no glaring omissions. But, you know, there's stuff that we probably would have fiddled with, you know, a lot of it even, but, like, I listen to it, I'm just like, this is as exciting to me as something that, you know, we went in with the microscope on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they say, like, all these old Beatles recordings they're not perfect.
And, yep.
You know, they would wait until their voices got raspy from singing all night or whatever.
I love the idea of like the 78s, you know, like think of like William Primrose, and you know, they at that point with the limitation of sound, like a lot of these first movement of these concerti were too long for one side of the 78. I love the idea of them having to like stop right in the middle of a movement, like, you know, put the acetate or whatever down and get ready for the second half and just like drop right into wherever they had broken off. Like, that is amazing. Like, what just kind of like emotional control you would need to be able to do that. And there just wasn't another option.
Yeah, I'm like, to have it at the same speed, because they couldn't speed up or slow them down back right. then.
Yeah.
You're lucky if two turntables spin at the same speed.
Exactly.
Pitch, even.
Yep.
Okay, so you're super into contemporary music.
Yep.
So, like, sell me on what's so great about it.
I mean, I think the first thing is just to not treat it as a monolith. Like, that's what's always so funny to me, is people are like, oh, new music. And it's like, that's like saying, like, oh, American food. It's like, well, you know, you just haven't had the thing that you really like yet. You know, you haven't discovered the, you know, the flavor that is really going to speak to you. So, I mean, to broadly try to answer your question, I think the main thing that pulls me in that direction is that traditional music, you know, just to use the obvious example, something like Beethoven, like when it's played really well, it is going to move me. Like, I know that it's going to speak to me on a certain level. But there's something that it can't do. It can't exactly speak to what it's like to be alive in the 21st century. And I don't necessarily mean contemporary music where there's a text involved or there's an overtly like political aim of the piece or something like that. But there is something about something being written now that is informed by just being a human being in this moment that can't be captured by historic music. And so there's that aspect of it. There's the novelty of like all these crazy, you know, techniques that we have to learn how to do. I mentioned microtonality earlier. Really complex rhythms. I mean, like breaking the code on some of that feels like it's just a really rewarding experience. But then once you get beyond the technique side of it or the rhythm side of it, it's the same thing as like your own traditional technique developing too, right? Once you're not thinking about it so much and you can just focus on the music making, like, that's so rewarding. Plus being able to, you know, sit in the room with the person and be like, hey, what's this about? And them actually being able to tell you rather than like, you know, a bunch of like, I don't know, I don't want to characterize musicologists, but like, you know, rather than expecting a book to tell us. I mean, that's what I love so much about, like, you know, the field that you spend so much time in with Baroque music, is like, there's all of this, you know, there's whatever information that we have to help inform how we do it, but nobody is really like slave to one way of going about it. You know what I mean? Like, to me, like, Baroque music is much more like jazz in some sense. Like, there's just much more agency given to the player.
Yeah, like everything you read says that you've got freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
And no two people would have played a piece the same way.
Yeah.
As long as you've got a, you know, some kind of affect in mind or
convincing.
Something,
like,
yeah.
Make it convincing, right? And there's some amount of contemporary music that's like that too. So like when we commission a piece, it's not uncommon for us to just in dialogue with the composer, like ultimately end up kind of shaping aspects of the piece, you know, like them hearing something out loud and being like, that's not exactly what I was after there. And like, you know, making some changes or even taking suggestions from us about like, you know, what about, I don't know, and it's not necessarily like, you know, rewriting something note-wise, but like there's something really exciting also about putting out the premiere recording of a piece. It's like, this is something I could never get by recording Ravel quartet. Like, there's a bajillion Ravel quartets out there, many of them will be better than I can play, but with this piece, like, I'm the authority, at least for a short time, right? Like, there's, you know, this is the recording of the piece informed by the composer being there and producing the album and like all that sort of thing. There's definitely like some, you know, there's maybe it's vain, but like there's something exciting about that too.
Totally. Yeah, and it's nice to hear that not all composers consider their work to be like the Ten Commandments. That, you know, you can edit it afterwards.
I can probably count on one hand the number of composers we came across that were like that. You know, and it's not like we're just throwing ideas around willy-nilly, but like it becomes sort of a problem to solve. If you know sort of like what the thing is that they're after, then it's like everybody gets in on it and it's like an escape room or something like that, right? Like we're all working towards the same goal.
But like an author, there's going to be proofreading, there's going to be editing, you know. You don't expect it to flow out like Bach or something, right, where he doesn't even like smudge the paper.
Well, I mean, that is one of the things that comes with commissioning a bunch of new work too, right? Is then you've got, you know, groups getting in touch with you being like, wait a second, how did you do, you know, this? Because it's a great reminder that the text, you know, the music, the sheet music, really, like, it only gives us so much. You know, it doesn't answer all of the questions. It can't. And so it's nice to actually, like, apply that to historic music too. And I'll admit, like, I don't know if I'll say which one, but like there's a Beethoven quartet that we like revoiced a couple of chords because they were just stupid the way they were written. And it's like, why am I worried about this? You know?
He's not going to come back and yell at you.
Also, like, he's not a deity. Like, he was a guy who was really good at something, but like he didn't do everything right in his life because nobody does everything right in their life. So. Totally.
All right. So tell me about the writing that you do. I know that you, besides playing the viola, you actually work writing stuff. So tell me a little about that.
Yeah, well, speaking of kind of like stumbling into things, a sort of younger sister of a college friend got in touch. She was working for Time Out Chicago and said, hey, our classical writer is kind of moving on, and I think that you ought to apply for this job. And I was just like, that's insane. Why would you think that I should do that? I don't have any writing credits to my name. However, I did go to a lot of concerts and a lot of festivals. And for some reason, I always had a notebook with me and I was always taking notes and just like writing extemporaneously about what I was hearing or things, you know, weird things that were happening in the audience or whatever. And so there was, you know, some of the groundwork was laid there. But I submitted a writing sample to them and apparently it was good enough. And that got the ball rolling. So, yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm doing a lot more, like, liner notes. I write essays for University Musical Society in Ann Arbor. And, yeah, I mean, the stuff I've been doing recently has been kind of more on the prose side of things rather than reviews. That was actually interesting when I was doing more reviewing, like for Chicago Magazine and Crane Chicago Business and stuff like that. I had to be careful about what I said I would review, and I generally try to take previews rather than reviews, because all y'all are my friends and I wanted to be, you know, I mean, I wanted to, you know, have some journalistic ethics about that, but also like didn't want to get caught in a place where I was having, you know, there are certain concerts where there's not, you know, there's not a lot positive to say about it. And I didn't want to get caught in a position with, you know, somebody that I knew. I don't think it would have been that common of an occurrence, but anyway. So yeah, the writing,
I mean,
we've
all played those.
We have all played those. That is absolutely true. But yeah, that really carried forward into all my work with Spectral. So if you read something, whether it be an email or a social media post or, you know, a year-end letter or something like that, generally it was coming from me. And I love doing it. It's hard to do. It's hard to write about music. But I do love it. And I especially like doing interviews, and I especially like doing liner notes. And so a lot of what I have out there is that. And even that's starting to, it's not transitioning, but, you know, like UMS there with the University of Michigan, they invited me to start a pre-concert kind of talk. And the idea is to make it interactive rather than just a lecture. And so I'm getting to basically conduct a great big experiment with people, you know, before the Berlin Philharmonic plays, that sort of thing. And I just find it really interesting. Like, it's really helpful to be reminded that we don't always give the audience credit, the credit that they deserve in terms of just how thoughtful they are, not how knowledgeable in terms of like how much music history they know, but like just how thoughtful they are about, you know, the political implications of a certain piece or about the way something, sounds. Like I find that like a lot of times maybe we unintentionally condescend to them in terms of their kind of emotional intelligence about a listening experience. And I'm just nonstop surprised at like just like how insightful people can be, whether or not they know anything about the composer or the group that's playing or anything else. And so that's what's fun about the interactivity of this particular thing. And I try to do that in my writing too. I try to make it entertaining, and I don't make any bones about that. Like, I pull in a lot of pop culture references, and I, you know, go off on, you know, three paragraph long sentences and stuff like that. Like, I have fun with it because I want to write something that I would enjoy reading. So no facts and figures, or facts and figures are tucked into, you know, references to, I don't know, 80s pop culture or something.
Yeah, I mean, if people are engaged and enjoying a performance, they will often have interesting things to say about it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's like all these things that people understand in marketing, somehow we tend to forget in classical music. It's like, if you can make somebody laugh, they'll remember whatever the thing is. I was at a concert recently where the music making was good. It was really good. But the thing I remember most about the concert was one of the performers telling a story about this like ornery frog at an outdoor concert that like would not shut up during like some really delicate, you know, middle movement of a string quartet. And like, I love that. Like, that's my takeaway from that concert, and that's okay. That like the playing was fine and whatever, but like, I love the fact that I got told this story about this stupid frog, because it's hilarious to imagine that. Like, you know, imagine the like Adagissimo or something like that being played, and this croaking frog that just will not let go. Like, and that's the approach that I take with most of the writing too.
But it's true. I mean, when a performer talks to the audience and actually connects in an interesting way, then it is memorable.
No, for sure. I mean, you tell somebody why. You tell somebody about a rehearsal where you just like ate it, like, or even a concert where you just like completely fell apart, or, you know, just some part of the piece that you're nervous, like that you're about to play, that you're nervous about because like it's only really gone really well like once or twice. It's like you humanize yourself to the audience and break that fourth wall and like remind them that you're also a human being. It's just like instant empathy from the audience. Like, they're all of a sudden they're on your side, they're cheering for you. And it also, at least in my experience, like, I don't deal a lot with stage nerves anymore, but like at a time when I did, there was a way that just like took out all the tension of the room, you know, get the audience to laugh, get them to sympathize with some, you know, stupid thing, some anecdote from rehearsal or a previous concert. Just all of a sudden, it's like a group of people that all want something great to happen, and you play differently.
All right. So do you have any advice for like young musicians or?
Advice for young musicians.
Don't do it.
Oh, man.
Play the viola.
Yeah, right. Play a weird instrument. What would be my advice for young musicians? I mean, I guess this might be a little bit of a roundabout answer, but I'm still surprised how kind of old-fashioned the career path still is in a lot of people's minds. That it's like, okay, I play in a bunch of youth orchestras when I'm a kid, and then I go to a conservatory and I study with the right teacher, and then I win some competitions, and then, you know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't exist anymore, and it hasn't for a really long time. And so, to that end, I think the one piece of advice I would give is that the thing that you get criticized for, or that people give you a hard time about, or that makes you a weirdo, that's your superpower. That's the thing that is going to differentiate you from everybody else when you're actually a professional. You know, when you're an adult, when you're a professional, when you're out there making a living, it's not worth trying to emulate other people. Like, that weird thing about you, in my case, being the weirdo in the back of the, you know, like being at some, I'm trying to think of like what band I can say that anybody will have any reference to, like being at the, you know, the Daft Punk show and like scribbling notes in the back while everyone else is dancing, like, that ended up being a little superpower. You know, it's like, it's that sort of thing. Or being a goofball and clowning around, like, that ended up being my superpower on stage when I was talking to an audience. And so I would just, yeah, pay attention to that. Like, it's hard to do when you're young, because that's the thing that you're probably getting ragged on about. But that's the thing that I think ultimately gets formed into, you know, the thing that's special that sets you apart once you're actually out there in the world.
Okay. So finally, like, my last question is always, is there anything you want to ask me?
Oh my gosh. So many things. So many of them not safe for work. When was the turning point for you where you developed a confidence for improvising on stage? Or was it more of a kind of slow burn into being able to do that? Because I think that a lot of people that have our training, like, are still terrified by that. Like, I still, like, that's where my nerves come up is an improvisation, even though I've been doing a lot more of it these days. And so I'm wondering, like, if there was a tipping point for you.
I think anything you do, it's all about preparation, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, and the type of improv I do is mostly just decorating a melody, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've done so much of it that I just feel pretty comfortable doing it. But in the beginning, I, you know, I'd crash and burn sometimes, and I still do once in a while, just play something that I'm just like, right. Oh, God. What's that?
That's what keeps it interesting, though, right?
Yeah. And so I think it's confidence is just earned by work.
It's like doing it and making sure.
Yeah.
No, I think that's true. I mean, is there a little bit of it, too, that's like doing it and realizing that, like, the world doesn't explode when it doesn't go well?
Yeah, nobody dies. Like, it's not, you're not
yet
a surgeon. You know, and someone in the audience isn't gonna like kill themselves because he didn't play the perfect ornament, you know. Oh my God, that trill.
I was hanging on by a thread, but that really pushed me over the edge.
Yeah, I was really hoping Marty would do a good one tonight, but no. That double relish is just like nasty.
Oh my gosh. I feel like there's like a Squid Game type TV show in there somewhere. Concerts where everything is on the line.
There's another aspect, though, and that it's like competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you want to be good at that, you have to want to be better than other people, maybe, you know, or just not sound like all the horrible ones that you've heard. You know, it's like, no, I'm not going to be like that. I'm going to be like legit, you know? So you've got to. There's a level I won't sink below, and just set the bar and just don't go below that. Just be hardcore about it.
But also be willing to fail on your way there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, enjoy it. I mean, being uncomfortable is also a pleasure.
Yep.
And expanding your comfort zone. I mean, mine's infinite, I think. All right. I feel like I could talk to you all night, but I don't want to keep you up too late. So we're going to take a little break and then come back and play a little duet. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the show and give us as many stars as possible. You can buy my arrangements and CDs and stuff on bachfor2.com. And do you have any website you want to plug, Doyle?
I mean, my website is forthcoming, but if people want to kind of stay aware of spectralquartet.com, we do have these albums coming out, and they are not afterthoughts. They are a group that is disbanding, saying we cannot leave as you know, we cannot leave existence as a group before these things are out in the world. So we're excited for everyone to hear them. And yeah, Behind the Wallpaper, March 3rd is the big release date, New Amsterdam Records.
Awesome. All right. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm.